Hello and welcome to Firestarters, the UK's first podcast for social enterprise and health. And this is the second part of the Adrian Ashton interview, looking at the pros and cons of community interest companies.
Okay, so I suppose one of the other ones that kind of crops up is the power to remove an individual director.
Yeah, now this is not unique. The regulator itself, so there's all these clauses you have to put in, which are mandatory. Now my concern is that KIC's adopting these models haven't considered these, how these relate to their values.
Yeah.
Every co-op cooperative KIC that I've come across, I've read a lot of stuff in the press, we're a cooperative, I hear about Co-op X, that's become a KIC, and said, we wanted to become a KIC because we wanted something that would enshrine our values.
Yeah.
So I get in touch with them, I email them, I ring them and say, look, help me understand this.
Yeah.
Co-op values about equality. You've adopted a model that forces people to have a second vote. Co-op model is about self-responsibility.
Yeah.
How does that tie up with the fact that you can just tell someone else to vote on your behalf and you don't take... How does that work? And none of them have come back to me on this.
Which I think is really interesting, because I think every board I've been on, these are tough things that boards have to talk about.
Yeah.
And there are different solutions. And to turn around and almost say, we're giving you this model, you have no choices.
Yeah.
It is kind of like, well, why? Where's that coming from?
Yeah. And I think a lot of it is because this has been this issue that there's no need for the community interest company to be accountable directly to its community.
Yeah.
So the regulator has to step in on behalf of the community. So the regulator, let's think about the powers of the regulator. Mm. And this is the other thing that most people don't realise.
Mm.
And when I go through with it with KICs, who haven't explored this or been told this by their quote-unquote specialist legal advisors, they go very white and pale.
Yeah.
So...
Because they've actually got a lot more powers than the Charity Commission.
They do.
And the Charity Commission has a lot of powers.
They do.
Yeah.
So they have the power to appoint and remove directors.
Yeah.
Technically, the Charity Commission can do that too, as well.
Now, I didn't think the Charity Commission could remove individuals. I thought it could dissolve a board, but I don't know if it could say, I don't like Joe Smith with, you know...
Yeah, it's one of these weird things. On record, the KIC regulator said we're going to be light touch.
Yeah.
So it hasn't used any of these powers, but they're there.
Yeah.
They're in the background. So the power to change, basically change your governance.
Yeah.
So they can remove and appoint directors of their choosing without consultation to you or deference to you, which is slightly concerning because they could do that at any time. Because the way they work, like the Charity Commission, they'll investigate you if there's a whistleblowing.
Mm.
Someone just has to ring them up and say, I think that KIC isn't behaving. Mm. And they'll come down and investigate you with the full powers.
Yeah.
So power to appoint and remove. The power to dissolve you or reinstate you.
Mm.
Let's think about some of the other ones. The power to restrict your trading activities.
Which a lot of people aren't aware of.
No, so let's bear in mind, you're a social enterprise. You're trading in the marketplace economy.
Yeah.
You have to be responsive to market forces.
Yeah.
You've got a regulator that says, no, I don't like the fact you're doing that as a trading activity. I'm going to stop you doing it.
Yeah.
How does that work? I haven't quite got my head around that one. But I think it's this issue of saying, because the KIC doesn't have to have accountability to its community directly, the regulator's acting on their behalf.
But you can also get a potential where, because there are a lot of KIC models where they have got accountability to the membership and the vote. So you can actually almost have the KIC saying, the regulator saying, we think this is in the best interest of you, the community. And the community's going, no, we disagree. We think this is in our best interest.
And the community then has the potential to go to their regulator to enact it on their behalf. So there is something to be said there. But the big thing that I think is the most concerning part of the KIC regulator's powers, and their toolbox of powers, that no one knows about, and worries the pants off people when they realise this, is that the KIC regulator has the power to instigate civil proceedings. Now that sounds a bit technically jargon. What it means is that if the KIC regulator so decides, they think it's in the interest of your community or protecting your asset, in the name of your KIC, they can sue any individual or organisation in your name without the need for your consent.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's quite a scary power for the regulator to have over you.
The KIC can sue people on your behalf without your approval.
Yeah.
No, I never know.
All this stuff is out there.
Right.
If you look on the KIC regulator's website, it's all hidden there in the small print.
And if you go to adrianashton.co.uk, it's there in big print in a slightly more prominent way.
The links are slightly clearer.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, but again, there's this issue. The KIC regulator said they're light touch.
Mm.
I've actually spoke when the KIC was in its kind of first year or two. I actually spoke with some of the regulators, John Hunt, the bigger ones, and challenged them, personally, informally, about some of these clauses and things. And I was told, no, that's not the case. You can take that clause out if you want to. And I had to say to the regulator, no, you can't, because I've tried to do that. So the regulator at that time wasn't aware.
And I had a similar one about four months in of KICs being done. We got a venture capital deal with the foundation. We wanted to convert the foundation to a KIC, but the rate of return for the venture capitalist was higher than the cap.
Yep.
And interestingly, they said, well, you can't. They said, quite literally, until that funding deal is finished, you can't become a KIC. And two of the regulators I spoke to didn't realise that, and the third one did, and in fact we had really good correspondence. And I will say, you know, as we both said, they are a really friendly, really accessible bunch.
And very open-minded.
But in 5 years, you could put a whole bunch of new people in, and suddenly they've got all of these powers to be able to do things.
And the danger is, because KIC is about a status, like the charity, charity is a status, it's a case of interpretation of the law.
Mm-hmm.
Company law, very straightforward. Company's house, also known as the biggest filing cabinet in the world.
Yeah.
If you tick the right boxes, if you fill in, put the signatures in the right places, it will be filed, it will be accepted. You will never hear from them again.
Yeah. Because I think 90% of directors are struck off for not returning their annual return.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with
because
behavior.
They just don't, that's it. With the KIC, with the charities, you know, the charities, KICs are about interpretation of those rules.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, it's much more of an application, a discussion. And that's where it can be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it worked in that instance, why shouldn't it work in the other instance? And it's this constant review. But it's like, you know, anything in your structure, the laws are changing all the time.
Well, and it's like the S&M Society that was turned down. I still think they're the only one that's been turned down.
Well, the interesting thing is they were never turned... The official line is...
Right.
They were never rejected. They chose to withdraw their application. So
really?
The Charity Commission's third situation. So the KIC regulator said, we can't accept your application in the current format.
Right.
If you change your community, if you broaden it out,
right.
So it's of a wider benefit to a wider group of people rather than this rather exclusive interest group, because we're interested, because it's a community interest company, it's a community of area, rather than just a community of individuals, we'll look at it with a view to accepting it.
But
they decided they couldn't do that.
And interestingly, I think the perception was, because it was a bit of a group that they were worried about the press, and they were a bit like, what do we do? It makes you think, well, what if your community is quite a marginalised community? What if it is sex workers or drug addicts or...
I mean, there's parallels. The Indian Sex Workers Cooperative
that
the government tried to disband a number of times, but actually couldn't.
I think the world's first social enterprise brothel. Really interesting case study. Yeah.
And again, people talk about the ethics. It's a social enterprise. What it does must be really ethical.
Yeah.
Well, actually, there's the Israeli Water Cannon Cooperative that can preload your tear gas canisters. What they do, the Thailand Lab Dancers Cooperative, you know, just because it's a co-op doesn't mean what it does is purely ethical.
Absolutely, yeah.
And maybe this is where the KIC comes in, because government, the state has said, if we're creating something that's very visible for social enterprise, we have to make sure it's safeguarding the promise of social enterprise, the potential, the sexiness and grooviness of social enterprise, and it doesn't besmirch the name, whatever that was pronounced.
And I think the other interesting thing is when people talk about social enterprises, they often think, oh, it's KICs and it's co-ops.
Yeah.
But I think I'm correct, and I think about 70% of social enterprises are companies limited by shares or guarantees. There's still not... The number of KICs is still pretty small.
No, the number of KICs is comparable to the number of industrial and provident societies.
Right, which is, again, a relatively... obscure's the wrong word, but people have heard a bit more about it, but they're not large numbers. But people talk about them as if there are loads of KICs, and you go, I think there's only about 3,000 or 4,000. Might be wrong.
Sounds like a lot.
It's,
and then you go, well, hang on a minute, there's like how many millions of people in the UK?
And there's supposed to be, what, 50-odd thousand social enterprises?
Last year on Social Enterprise Day, official government website and the Cabinet Office website, depending what time of the day you went on, the number was changing.
Yeah, absolutely.
By quite big jumps. So it's still a relatively small proportion. Interestingly, though, one of the in terms of... So we talked a lot about the theory, some of the minutiae of the detail, the implications.
Yeah.
But again, I've been approached by groups and I've worked with groups who said, we've been through all that, we understand it, but we are willing to compromise to find a way to reconcile those values, those issues, those risks, because it gives us this badge, it gives us this credibility with this particular group of people who we really want to align ourselves with.
Mm.
That's fine. And I've gone through the motions with them and we've got them kick status and it's been great.
Mm.
On the flip side of that, I've actually been approached, I was approached within 2 years of the kick going live by a group to say, how do we unbecome a KIC?
Oh, really?
Because we've become a KIC, because we thought it's a thing to do, but it hasn't worked out. And interestingly, a lot of KICs, the majority of KICs, are not company limited by share.
Yeah, there often can be limited guarantee.
Because the idea was, let's have the kick as the share, with a share option, because that will allow for investment to be raised more easily.
Yeah.
Those share kicks aren't seeing it happen.
Yeah.
Because private investors are going, well, I don't want to get my return. And you're telling...
And actually, most of the conversations I've had with people, particularly where there's a small steering group that got an idea they want to set it up, I would say one of the acid tests I say is if you want to raise finance in the first 5 years, you may find it a lot more useful to be to have share capital than burn by guarantee. Not to say guarantee is wrong, but I think certainly for a lot of the people that I talk to, I say that from what I'm hearing, the share route gives you a lot more options. You don't have to use it, you don't have to issue it. But if you're limited by guarantee, you can't get you really can't get equity investment, and that's a huge chunk of the market. So.
But I mean, in terms of it's not only about raising finance. Cafe Director, a great case study.
Yeah.
In terms of how you can use public shares.
Yeah.
So they basically entrenched their customer base because they said to all their customers, buy shares in us.
Yeah.
You know, subject to all the, you know, they put all the caveats, the limits on share dividend, the limits on the asset lock, and people can't make a profit out of owning shares in Cafe Director, in effect.
Yeah.
But what it's meant is that they've, you know, let's say, you know, they raised about £1 million. Let's assume that's £1 a share. Let's assume that customers didn't buy more than one share each.
Yeah.
That's 1 million customers that they've locked in for life.
Yeah.
Because I'm a share in that business. I'm not going to switch to someone else.
And there
I'm
is
not
a different
risk my investment.
And I think there is a different mentality between members and owners.
Yeah.
And if all the members are owners, they look at things differently. And in fact, something we talked about with Central Surrey, that you know, the idea that all the employees feel that they own the organisation they work in, which is a big draw for co-ops.
And if you put that financial benefit, that financial aspect on it as well, very often people get involved in social enterprise because of the socially stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's warm and it's fuzzy and it's great. And those are absolutely fine and appropriate. But there is this aspect of enterprise.
Yeah.
And if you want people who are committed, who are serious on your board, as your workforce, your supporters, there has to be some kind of personal stake.
Yeah.
And as crude as and as crass as it may sound, the easiest way to do that is make it financial.
Yeah.
But again, the ethics of that are somewhat contested at the moment. But again, 10 years ago, people were saying you can't be a social enterprise if you're a company limited by shares.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're saying, yeah, you can be a PLC in a social enterprise. No problem, be what you want to be.
And in fact, in terms of health, the government's come up with this, to me, slightly bizarre ruling that you can keep in the NHS pension scheme if you're a company limited by shares and all your shares are owned by staff.
Mm.
And they've come up with this ruling, and it's like, why? And I don't know why they came up with the Department of Health, but I've come across health social enterprises where they've gone, we want the shares to be owned by the community and the patients and the people we serve. And we go, fine, then you're not in the NHS pension scheme. Because at the moment, the NHS pension scheme is only for employee-owned organisations. And quite why they ended up with that model, I've no idea.
Possibly because employee-owned organisations is something which government, I think, is very quietly trying to push the agenda on.
Yeah, I'm kind of all for different models of ownership, but to me, if you're trying to support a community, there's a difference between the people delivering the service owning it and the people receiving the service owning it. And I'm not saying one's right or wrong, but to suddenly go, this is the best model, without even going... Yeah. Well, you know, there might be other ways of doing it.
But maybe that's it in terms of, you know, we're talking about models, talking about a specific model of the community interest company. It's still new.
Yeah.
People are trying it out, they're pushing it in different ways. I've come to this, I'm being interviewed on this because I have a certain personal take on it.
Yeah.
I've looked at it from a values perspective. I've tried to have conversations with KICS. I've had a conversation with the regulator. I've had stuff in the press about it.
But you have a critical analysis of KICS, and actually it's rare. I mean, the number of times I go to places where they just push KICS.
Mm.
KICS are great. KICS are social enterprises. There is no downside to KICS. You want to be a KICS.
Now, interestingly, a little story to illustrate that point about how much they've been pushed. Perhaps just do a quick summing up because I'm conscious of time, and we've been going on for a while now, and people might be getting bored of our voices at this point, or going, oh, I'm on the train and getting to the station, I've got to stop soon.
Okay.
There is a National Social Enterprise Awards ceremony.
Oh, right.
Enterprising Solutions.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Which Divine Chocolate won last year.
Gosh, what really did they? Didn't see that one coming.
No, absolutely.
But they are a very good flagship social enterprise. And interestingly...
It's not as good as green and black chocolate, but it's more ethical.
Well, it's interesting for me because I have a personal preference for co-ops.
Right.
And it's interesting that this hugely successful flagship social enterprise is based on co-op models.
Yeah.
Anyway, and at this conference, a certain person from the Social Enterprise Coalition, who I don't wish to name at this point, but people can probably guess, lent over to someone I know who's one of the finalists.
Right.
In the camp, they're doing all the speeches. Mm-hmm. Lent over to this finalist, who was from a worker co-op, and said to him, "So, when are you going to become a kick?"
Really?
And this is a business that's, yeah, this finalist has been in business for 20 years, a successful social franchise for over 10 years. Mm-hmm. Massively successful social firm model, everything else, never had any grants. Why would they want to do it? But yeah. It was being pushed.
Yeah.
What's up, Dan? And that's it. So, maybe just a few summing up comments from my perspective.
Yeah.
And then we'll let you do the end credits.
Okay.
With the soundtrack and the music we've got now.
You know, I usually do that on my own with a headset and I'm kind of mixing it.
Or in your bedroom at night.
Yeah.
Late at night. Yeah. No, I'm not going to go any further. Yeah. Okay, so community interest companies.
It's World of Warcraft. It's a finely balancer.
Community interest companies, they came about because it seemed inevitable.
Yeah.
Certain things were happening that all came together at the same time. They were birthed. There was a lot of excitement about them, politically, legislatively, and so on again, for various reasons. But they are one of a number of models that you can adopt.
Mm.
Some people have adopted them because it gives them the edge, that visibility with certain parties, certain commissioning bodies, certain partner organisations, certain communities. That's fine. There's pros to them, there's cons to them, like any legal structure. My personal take on this is that people haven't thought about them enough before adopting it.
Mm-hmm.
They've rushed in, they've suddenly got the structure, and they haven't realised actually what they've exposed themselves to and what they're liable for. And that concerns me.
And in fact, if I can just do a very quick aside, one of my most interesting stories about kicks, I got a phone call from someone saying, "I want to be a kick." And I said, "What's your business model?" And their business model was, "We want to do work with disadvantaged communities, and we'll get paid for that through grants and through fundraising activity." And I said, "Why aren't you a registered charity?"
Yeah.
And they said, "Well, no, we want to be a kick." And I said, "What you've just described is the core model for a charity."
Yeah.
"So why on earth do you want..." And they'd been pushed down this route. Yeah. And in fact, I said to them, "Go back, look at being a registered charity."
So. Yeah. So for some people, kicks are entirely appropriate.
Yeah.
Entirely great, and they're very happy with them.
Yeah.
Yeah, take them home, polish them every night. Great. My concern, though, is that a lot of people have rushed to adopt them.
Mm.
But then I see with other models as well that people have adopted over the years. I guess my overriding concern, my thing that I always keep coming back to, is saying if you are considering setting up a social enterprise or reviewing your model, your starting point should be, what is it you're doing?
Yeah.
How are you wanting to do it?
Yeah.
Who are you involving? How is it being financed? And what's your long-term vision?
Mm.
Once you've worked all those out, find a model that best fits that.
Absolutely.
And in terms of wrapping all of that around your values as well.
Yeah. Thinking about that before you go jump down.
And that makes it so much easier to pick your legal model. Because I've seen it again, time and time again, people saying, you know, groups saying, "Oh, you know, we went to negotiate for the contract, but we were told we couldn't be considered because we weren't a kick or we weren't a charity." And I say to them, "Well, why didn't you tell them why you didn't adopt that model? Oh, we didn't think of that."
Yeah.
So, but if you're in a negotiating position with a grant investor, with a private investor, with a commissioning officer, and they say, "Well, we would consider you, but you're not a kick, so you're not really a social enterprise, are you?" If you can turn around and say, "You're right, we're not a kick because it would mean we couldn't do this, this, and this."
Yeah.
So instead, we can now do this, this, and this.
Yeah.
Better for you. Then it keeps you in control. It keeps that power going.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I should probably mention in terms of the cons that I realised I didn't was there is a restriction on activity from kicks that underlines all kicks.
Right.
And it's a shared restriction with a charity. You cannot set a kick up with a primary purpose of political campaigning.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can set
a
business...
There's a couple of restrictions. There's political campaigning. Isn't there a couple of other ones?
That's the main one.
That's the main, yeah.
But again, so if you're setting up a kick to do regeneration or to challenge inequality or to challenge, you know, to do stuff about asylum seekers, which may mean you have to look at government legislation to do it, you may have an issue, even though it's a trading activity. So, I don't know. But pros and cons... But it's your enterprise. It's your model. It's your structure. You have to live with it. You should clear yourself up about what's involved. If you're in doubt, ask someone. Ask other people who have done it. How did it be for them?
Brilliant. And on that note, you can ask Adrian. And the best way to get a hold of you? Through the website?
Yeah, stick my name into an internet search engine. Adrian Ashton, and see what comes up.
Fantastic. All right, well, cheers, Adrian, and thanks very much to the cafe for putting up with us.
Number 72, Todmorden.
Which is very good, even if they do play really loud music during the middle of a podcast.
But it is really great music.
It is. It is good music. And that's the end of this week's podcast.
Fantastic. Cheers.
Well, thank you for listening. This was Firestarter, the UK's first podcast for social enterprises in health. And you can find more on our website at entrepreneurses.net. That's ENT, REP, RENURSES.net. My name's been Dave Dawes, and the music's Fire Dance by DJ Booley through a Creative Commons license, which you can find out more on the website. Hope to see you next week. Bye.